Now, I said already something some time ago about mercantilism becoming the dominant economic system in the 17th century. And we must now go back and look at the economic situation somewhat more closer. For mercantilism is, in a very real sense, the economic counterpart to the absolute monarchy, which we have studied. For just as that monarchy viewed politics as something to be done in the dynastic rather than in the private interest, so mercantilism was the first kind of national economic planning. It was national economic planning, but it was still dependent upon an older and feudal view of wealth. The view of wealth was still that which I once talked to you about in 17th century Burgundy, when the Duke, in order to prove his solvency, simply got some chests of gold into the marketplace and asked people to lift them. Well, De Gaulle today wishes he had that. But still, well, we have, in a way, gone much further. But the idea is still basically the idea to keep as much gold into the country as possible, to keep it in the country as much as possible, and to have as little as possible flowing out of the country. This meant, of course, concretely, more exports than imports. Imports mean gold flowing out. Exports, of course, mean that you can actually get gold flowing in. Now, underlying this mercantilist theory and accompanying it is the phenomena you are reading about in your Neff book, known sometimes as the First Industrial Revolution. But in reality, the rapid economic upswing, which took place roughly between 1550 and 1700. And at this we must now look in somewhat greater detail. First of all, there is no doubt that these years saw a greater supply of money coming into Europe, not just from one source, but from two sources. From the New World, to be sure, and you know about that from high school, but also from the Austrian silver mines and the Hungarian silver mines, newly discovered. And this greater availability was a great stimulus to the accumulation of capital. But it wouldn't have been enough. An added stimulation was the ever greater need of money by monarchs. Monarchs who could no longer live off their own at a time of inflation. And we've been around that already, how this is due to population pressure. I told you that once before. At a time of inflation and increased bureaucratic expenses, increased expenses having to do with the nobility at the court and all of that sort of thing. As a result, the monarchs had to borrow money at interest. And the 16th century is therefore the heyday of the great banking houses, like the House of Fugger in Germany. These banking houses made their fortune on loaning money to the emperor, to Charles V, on the part of Fugger, or to monarchs. But they were family enterprises, behaving in the end like dynasties themselves. They too made good marriages. For example, a marriage in the House of Fugger meant the control of the Fugger firm over Hungarian silver mines. That is, a control of a great deal of the European silver supply through a marriage. Charles V and his successors, but also other princes, were constantly in debt to a family like the Fuggers. They paid off the debt partly by giving over taxes and revenues to the banking house, partly by other means. You've seen one means already during the Reformation. Indulgences were sold to pay off a debt, this time again, a debt to the Fuggers, as a matter of fact. The indulgence Luther saw was in part an effort to raise money for the House of Fugger. Now, obviously, these combines gave great stimulus to capitalist development. But they did not last, for the great banking dynasties lent to monarchs, but the monarchs also ruined them. For sooner or later, they all defaulted on their loans. And when they defaulted on their loans, there was absolutely nothing you could do about it. That is how the Fuggers were in the end ruined. That is how many, by the 17th century, many of the big banking dynasties were ruined. Yet, these banking families, with their capital available, increasingly exploited raw materials, increasingly went in for a large import-export trade, a great stimulus to the whole European trade pattern, which is certainly true, again, for the House of Fugger. Now, if this is one factor, the second factor is that the monarchy, in its attempt at national unification, needed money, and it got it not only by taking up loans, but also by itself exploiting raw materials and manufacture. This was not handled the same way in all countries, as you know from your Neff reading, and I won't really repeat it here. In France, under Colbert, the government entered the industrial and manufacturing process directly. The government directly became a controlling partner in new enterprises, from the new silk industry in the Rhone Valley to the salt mines, to the newly discovered and exploited salt mines. This undoubtedly tended to prevent private capital accumulation in France, though the government went into it in the first place because there was not enough capital to get things going. What it meant is that sooner or later, a great premium was placed upon the development of a strong, economically strong class in a nation. This developed in France as well, but in a slower rate than, let us say, in England, and in the slowest rate in Germany itself. The direct government monopoly, as in France's new industry, tended, of course, to become tied up in bureaucracy, but it always had a partnership, nevertheless, with stronger economic forces in the nation. The vital instrument for exploiting new industries and starting up new economic endeavors, the instrument were the so-called monopolies, and these monopolies became a vital part, both of furthering new endeavor and of regulating it. They were both encouragement and regulation. This for good reasons. There was obviously much risk in developing new manufacture, and it was felt that those who engaged in it had to be hedged about and given a monopoly. In France, again, this was a direct government monopoly. But it was also felt that through giving a monopoly, the crown would get a rake-off, because these monopolies were sold, and sold by the crown at high prices. It was also felt, however, that you could regulate these monopolies, keep them in mercantilist terms from importing too much, and encourage them for export. Most of these monopolies were definitely encouraged by their charters to go in for export. So it was also a matter of regulation. In England, the monopolies, however, were granted to private merchants, and the government granted the charter and regulated it by charter, but the actual running of the monopoly was done by groups of private merchants. Because in England there was enough capital accumulation so that a private entrepreneur could undertake this task, or a group, better, of private entrepreneurs could undertake this task. The result was a much more rapid development, of course, of capital accumulation in other hands than the government, in England than it was in France. The end result was that the 17th century sees a host of new industries. In England, such thing as sugar refining, brass factories, saltpeter plants, and it's a good measure of how things were going when we see that the output of coal, which was used, of course, for a great deal of this new manufacture, the output of coal increased eightfold from 1940 to 1960. And what did this increase of coal mean? For one thing, as it were, plays into the hands of the other. The increase of coal means what? Very simply, it means the need for capitalistically managed blast furnaces. And ever larger scale you needed the blast furnaces. You had to manage them ever greater, and therefore you needed greater capitalist accumulation, a much more rapid development. Now, such commercial development was too much for one individual merchant. And even in England, therefore, a new idea came about. A new idea which was the joint stock company. The joint stock company, what was the joint stock company? The joint stock company was merchants joining together to do this kind of exploitation. And that the government gave the... Well, you know, there's nothing I can do to admit students from Oshkosh.
I don't care one way or another.
If they want to go, they can go. But I don't think I should otherwise, really. You know. If they want to go, they can go. It's not a very interesting lecture. I'll tell them I won't keep you here. If you want to have your sympathy, you can go. Isn't that a good idea? Well, it beats the joint stock company, but I won't keep anyone who wants to be in sympathy. Far be it from me. So you can do whatever you want to. What? Well, that's not my business. I'm here to lecture on the joint stock company, which I shall do, and if you want to leave, you can leave. That's up to you. But I don't think, as I don't know the cons and anything of this, that I should certainly... I don't keep you, I don't force you in any case. Now, the joint stock company, as I said then, was a matter of getting the merchants together, and as merchants together, as it were, to get a charter, and that charter by royal regulation, in the same kind of way as I have said, this royal regulation indeed worked for the individual kind of companies. Now it must be clear, therefore, that with that sort of control already there, the commercial classes in England were indeed extremely powerful and getting more powerful. And it is small wonder, therefore, that encouraged in export and encouraged in having export market, it were the joint stock companies which first began what we might call the imperial drive, whether it is in Massachusetts Bay or India. Indeed, until 1853, India was run by the East India Company, a joint stock venture. Only in 1853 was India, after all, as it were, under the British government, properly speaking. Now, this meant then that in England, commercial and manufacturing interests were powerful enough to make themselves felt, as they could not make themselves felt in France. They wanted a mercantilist policy, and they wanted to control it. After 1688, they managed to get such a control. And the landmark for that was the founding of the Bank of England in 1694. The Bank of England, which was founded in a way as a result, if you like, as a result of the joint stock companies, as a result of the kind of capital accumulation which I have tried to outline. For the Bank of England was founded as a joint stock enterprise. Now why? Because the monarchs, William and Mary, ran out of sources from which to borrow money. And so they said to the merchants, in effect, do what the House of Fugger did in for Charles V, do for us. But instead, it being the English situation, a group of merchants got together in a joint stock company and said, all right, we will be the only source for your borrowing, but we will have a monopoly on it. And thus, the Bank of England grew up as a monopoly on all government borrowing. Now, what is so important about that? Because the Bank of England, being a monopoly on government borrowing, could control money and credit. For the government, that is, the king, constantly had to borrow. And so constantly there could be a control of money and credit, as it were, through this government borrowing. And yet the Bank of England was not directly controlled, we must not forget, by the government. In fact, what it did, to be brief about it, it put the economy into the hands of the wealthier merchant classes, where in England it remained, where they could exploit the economy for capital accumulation, where they could exploit the economy to get, in a way, the Industrial Revolution started. Yet the merchants were not the only beneficiary, for indeed the monarchy also benefited. Through the charter, it could regulate. It got a ready source of money. And it managed to get a national economic policy. Now, we must ask ourselves for a minute, what were the forces opposed, as it were, to all of this? For that we must realize, the forces opposed were not the monarchs. They gave the charter. The forces opposed were the old guild structure. And the question was always, should the guild structure be maintained? Now why? Because the guilds had monopolies on trade and manufacture. And the monopoly of the guilds was archaic. It dated back to the Middle Ages. It was the master and craftsman relationship. And as the guilds had this kind of manufacture, that kind of monopoly, what it meant in practice is that the guilds could oppose this development. They could go to town, especially against the new industries. Industries like textile and mining, which were not handicapped by a guild structure because they were new industries, but which they tried to bring under the guild structure. For we must not forget something else. The guilds also regulated prices for their wares, so that you have a pretty complete and archaic monopoly. Here the government stepped in. For example, the government of Elizabeth stepped in England. And in 1601, in the Statute of Apprentices, so-called Statute of Apprentices in 1601, the government of Elizabeth regulated the time of apprenticeship, how a man could become a master, tried really to modernize the guild system. That was really what was involved. And again in England, this had some success. But in Germany, it had no success at all. There the guilds will stay dominant until pretty late in the day. And yet, the guild structure was running into severe trouble. Why? Because with their archaic practices, it became clear very soon in the 17th century that indeed the guilds, ever more monopolistic, led towards unemployment. How? Well, the guild relationship, I must remind you, was this. You became an apprentice, and then a journeyman, and then a master. For the master, you did your famous masterwork. But there came a time now, with the new industries, with the old methods, that the masters became ever more monopolistic, that the masters were ever more reluctant to accept journeymen as masters. And therefore, by the 16th and 17th century, you have the growth, for the first time in Europe, I think, of a real proletariat, namely the apprentices and the journeymen who could never hope to be masters. In the English Revolution, they played a role in London. They played a role in every riot. They played a role, in fact, in the parliamentary army as well. From now on, through the fossilization of the guild structure, you have a proletariat growing up. How did the government try to cope with it? It coped with it quite inadequately through the poor laws, the laws concerning the poor. For unemployment was not yet recognized as unemployment. If you were unemployed, what was the idea? The idea was that you were too lazy to work. And therefore, poor houses were established. no longer merely as by the reformers to take care of those who were unable to work. But poorhouses now, which were not merely charity, but poorhouses where the so-called lazy poor were set to work with the whip, where conditions were of the most dreadful you can imagine, where people were put who were found unemployed. For we must remember about all of this one all-important fact, that economic failing was as yet regarded as moral failing, that it all took place within a Christian framework, that there was no such thing yet, really, as economic criticism. It was always moral criticism. Why was there so much unemployment? Well, okay, the poor were lazy, but there was other thing. The rich liked luxury, and the idea you hear constantly is if the rich would give up their luxuries, then everything would be fine in the economic world. And you hear with it that if men wouldn't rise above their station, everything would be fine in the economic world, if men would not rise above their station. That is to say, and it shouldn't surprise you, that medieval attitudes were applied to a system that was getting more and more modern, more and more, as it were, rationalized and modern all the time. But people didn't realize that unemployment comes with this capitalist development, that they won't realize till the late 19th century. But the criticism is always a moral criticism in this regard. This is how they saw it. The poor must be put to work. Now it must be clear that the beginnings of capitalism do not lie in free enterprise, whatever that means, and if it has ever existed, which is doubtful. It lies rather in the development of a mercantilist economy, which was essentially a regulated economy. First of all, monopolies. Secondly, protective tariffs. That comes with the idea of the balance of money, which I already talked about. The Navigation Acts, which you all know from high school and can read again in Europe in Review, are a part of all of this. These instruments of mercantilist regulation were applied to the mother country and to the colonies. They were opposed by whom? First of all, those merchants who wanted to get in, but were prevented. That is how monopolies plays into the English Revolution. That's why you have the entire attack on monopolies in the English Revolution. Secondly, by the consumer, for monopolies drove up prices, they really did, and restricted the market. But thirdly, also by the guilds, the old archaic guild structure, which was causing the problems and causing the unemployment. The good thing about it was that it was, first of all, a spur to new inventions, to the better exploitation of raw material. And that again, and you must remember that, plays into the rise of science. The early scientific developments were in order to better exploit raw materials. Pascal's adding machine, Boyle's water pump for mining. Early science tended to be applied science under the mercantilist system of attempting to exploit raw materials. Secondly, it changed, of course, in a way, the tenure of life, but only in an indirect way. The first benefit were what we would call public utilities. The invention of the water pump by Mr. Boyle meant the formation of water companies in the cities, joint stock companies again, made possible regular water supply. And if you try to sneeze at that, it prolonged life. And if you've ever been to Mexico, you know what I mean. Similarly, you have it in lighting, for example. Not unimportant. Before this time, what lighting there was in towns were when individual citizens hung out lanterns before their houses. But by 1692, a joint stock company was formed in London, the Glass Globe Light Company. And in 1692, you get the first regular street lighting anywhere, typical enough, in London. Now, all this had its effect. What it did not affect as yet directly were communications. Though that also begins to change the tenure of life. In 1680, the first regular postal service in England again, the so-called penny post, which carried letters from one part of London to another, but in 1680, the beginning of regular postal service. Now, this kind of upsurge laid the foundation for the second and most famous English Revolution, furthered by mercantilism. As you will see from Europe in Review, and I won't talk about it now, the expansion of Europe is an integral part of it because of the idea of bullion, because of the idea that you should not import but only export. That also must be clear. Two final things, very rapidly. First of all, we must remember, therefore, that with this mercantilism, the cast of mind was still, if you like, a moralistic cast of mind. The religious obstacles to usury were being overcome. Calvin helped, because he believed that you could only take usury for public good. He distinguished, remember, between a productive and non-productive loan. This is quite true. But generally, interest rates were set at about 6% so as to avoid greater mischief, which is already a view of economic ideas, which there predominate. So that the Christian barrier on usury was dropping even, let us say, mentally. For in reality, it had never really existed, always been explained away. But now it drops even mentally. And by and large, if you set 6% of interest to avoid greater mischief, you already have pretty good economic rather than moral ideas, if usury is forbidden as it is in the Bible. This is clear. And secondly, this upsurge left one part of the economy and the major part of the economy totally behind. It did not as yet meaningfully affect the agrarian situation. And agriculture was the dominant occupation. Villages still existed in self-sufficient isolation. But worse, villagers were being deprived ever since the Middle Ages of their land by the enclosure, enclosing for sheep, for the textile market, which was more profitable and, if you like, less trouble. So that, as I told you before, enclosure went on, driving peasants off the land, but much more serious, driving up the price of food supply, because that land was taken out of, if you like, food supply and put into supply of textiles. Immediately much more profitable, but it again added to the spiraling inflation of those centuries. Because as you took land out of food supply, the pressure of the population was getting ever greater. It is in the 17th century that many European cities pass the 100,000 mark, that many European cities really become large, and that population really increases. And therefore, you're taking land out of food supply at the same time that you have this enormous increase in population. Therefore, the inflation goes on. The inflation goes on and still plays a role in everything that we have really discussed and in everything that I have really had to say about it. But you must not get the idea that all of Europe was being enclosed for sheep. This was regional and isolated. Most of the villages as yet existed in isolation, as yet farmed their plots, had their common land, and moreover found an extra source of revenue, namely home labor. As you get the growth of industry, you don't get big factories. You don't get that yet. The labor was parceled out among the peasant by the agent and then collected again. Above all, as many of you know, this was true in the textile industry. So while some peasants were being driven off the land by enclosures, others found an even new reason to stay on the land by what we call the spread of home industry, the weaving in the peasant's living room, the spread of home industry, which was what took the place of factories. Because factories, they are not yet in any number at all, because there isn't as yet any machinery of any number. You must exempt from that the blast furnaces and that kind of industry. But by and large, the factory system only starts properly in the 18th, not as yet in the 17th centuries. Mercantilism, therefore, finally, is a part of the absolute monarchy. It is a system, and it was, with all the criticism, a highly successful system of a regulation. A system which allowed enough capital accumulation so that indeed the factory system could get going in the 18th century. And moreover, it is a part of the absolute monarchy. It is far from free trade. And it is a part, therefore, also of the growing centralization of power, whether you think of centralization of power in the monarchy or whether you think of centralization of power in that merchant class, which is, in fact, the wealthy class which controlled the Bank of England and therewith the currency in England itself. This is all a centralization of power process of which is added. A centralization of power process which will, of course, have profound consequences for everyone else. And yet, you must not overrate that as over against the political. The wars were not yet economic wars, but rather dynastic wars, by and large. Even Cromwell, when he thought of the empire, thought of the empire in terms that were religious, a Protestant empire, rather than in economic terms. He anyway very rarely thought in these cast of mind, apparently. And what you have, therefore, is still the political scene as determining a great deal of what goes on. And what went on in the 17th century, apart from the absolute monarchy and mercantilism, best, of course, under Louis XIV, what went on are the rise of new nations, which will profoundly disturb the European balance of power. Because we have seen the rise of the nation state, but now there are new nations in the 17th century, joining that family, confusing it, grasping for power. Above all, two of them, Russia and Prussia. And I will reverse the order of talking about them. I will talk on Wednesday first about Russia, and then I will talk after Thanksgiving about Prussia. Now again, I stop 10 minutes early, as I have agreed to do, for questions. Let me say one thing.